incremental change. Now from there, he moves on, because he ends this with the action of the consciousness force. So there is a movement from the instruments to the energy. So this is the way in which Sri Aurobindo is proceeding in drawing out the nature of the Gnostic change. First, he's talking about what will happen to the instruments. And in a way, this follows a kind of a trajectory not very dissimilar from what he is doing in the yoga of self-perfection, in the synthesis of yoga. That is the perfection of the instruments. And then there is a movement to the energy, which is what we covered as Shakti, or Shakti Chatushtaya, Chit Shakti. Then there is a movement from there to being, through, in this case, another principle, which is the principle of Ananda. So here he's talking about the Shakti, which is the power that will use the instrument, and then the being of the person, Purusha, who is the true Karta or doer, that will be the user of the energy itself. So this paragraph, we can read, it is the incompleteness and weakness of the consciousness force, where now from the instrument he's moving to the nature of energy or Shakti, which itself in the ignorance is compromised. I think we can start there.
I'm happy to start reading it live.
Go for it.
Which is the incompleteness and weakness of the consciousness force manifested in the mental, vital, and physical being, its inability to receive or refuse at will, or receiving to assimilate or harmonize the contacts of the universal energy cast upon it, that is the cause of pain and suffering. In the material realm, nature starts with an entire insensibility, and it is a notable fact that either a comparative insensibility or a deficient sensibility, or more often a greater endurance and hardness to suffering, is found in the beginnings of life in the animal, in primitive or less developed man. As a human being grows in evolution, he grows in sensibility and suffers more keenly in mind and life and body. For the growth in consciousness is not sufficiently supported by a growth in force. The body becomes more subtle, more finely capable, but less solidly efficient in its external energy. Man has to call in his will, his mental power, or dynamize, correct, and console his nervous being, force it to the strenuous tasks he demands from his instruments, steel it against suffering and disaster. In the spiritual ascent, his power of consciousness and its will over the instruments, the control of spirit and inner mind over the outer mentality and the nervous in the body increases immensely. The tranquil and wide equality of the spirit to all shocks and contacts comes in and becomes the habitual poise, and this can pass from the mind to the vital parts and establish there too an immense and enduring largeness of strength and peace. Even in the body, the state may form itself and meet inwardly the shock of grief and pain and all kinds of suffering. Even a power of will, physical insensibility can intervene, or a power of mental separation from all shock and injury can be acquired. It shows that the ordinary reactions and the debile submission of the bodily self to the normal habits of response of material nature are not obligatory or unalterable. Still more significant is the power that comes on the level of still mind or over mind to change the vibrations of pain into vibrations of ananda. Even if this were to go only up to a certain point, it indicates the possibility of an entire reversal of the ordinary rule of the reacting consciousness. It can be associated too with the power of self-protection that turns away the shocks that are more difficult to transmute or to endure. The Gnostic evolution at a certain stage must bring about a completeness of this reversal and of this power of self-protection, which will fulfill the claim of the body for immunity and serenity of its being, and for deliverance from suffering, and build in it a power for the total delight of existence. A spiritual ananda can flow into the body and inundate cell and tissue. A luminous materialization of this higher ananda bring about a total transformation of the deficient or adverse sensibilities of physical nature.
So, yes, I now remember that we did do this particular paragraph in which he's talking about the nature of Shakti or consciousness force in the instruments. What is the type of Shakti manifest in the human instruments? And he's pointing out that in an evolutionary sense, this development of Shakti, the qualities of Shakti, follows a certain course in which consciousness develops gradually in the instruments. And so, as he has pointed out, in the development of evolutionary consciousness, we start from inconscious. And that inconscience, material inconscience, is also in terms of the experience of affect, the experience of delight or of feeling, marked by what is known as insentience. So insentience is the condition of the inconscience. Now this insentience gives a certain kind of insensitivity to the lower orders of the evolving consciousness. And hence, there is, as it were, a less, greater kind of thickness of consciousness, a less developed response of consciousness in the instruments at lower levels. Now, this is something that is, in fact, a boon, because as the consciousness becomes more subtle, more organized, we find that the sensitivity also increases. The resolution of the sensitivity also gets heightened. So we find, for example, that those creatures in whom the nervous, instrument is not properly organized, experience a much more, generalized sense of consciousness as a sensibility. But with a greater organization, there is also a greater fineness and higher resolution and intensity of the experience of sense. So from there, he points to the fact that in our stage, there is a kind of falling between two stools that has taken place. This is one of the problems of this intermediate condition of being human. One of our human, specifically human difficulties, is that we have a highly developed instrument of sensing and a subtler consciousness, which is therefore highly sensitive. This has also increased over time. Modern evolutionary theory, your responses and experiences. Contemporary experiences may be said to be more finely sensitive than even what we were maybe 100 years ago, as we were discussing last time. Because mankind, even 100 years ago, was more, could accept more easily conditions of suffering as their normal lot, human-caused suffering. Today we find that certain types of suffering that we imposed on ourselves and on others of our kind are much less prevalent, and we are much more easily outraged by their incidents. This itself is a sign of the subtilization of consciousness in its sensibility or sensitivity. Now, on the other hand, the interesting thing he's pointing out is that has resulted in a loss of force, that has in fact caused us this extreme sensitivity or increased sensitivity has caused mankind to become liable to greater suffering. This is the suffering of sensibility. Now, why is that the case? That is also quite interesting to consider. As he's pointing out, with regard to the ascent of the spiritual consciousness, what is really happening in this uneasy transition that human beings go through is that there is a matter of the growth of prakriti, but the loss of purusha. In other words, purusha is awakening, but a reversal of consciousness must make up for the deficiencies that the increase of consciousness in prakriti brings in. Increase of consciousness in prakriti without the awakening of the purusha causes certain problems. These are the problems we are talking about. The beginning of the sign of the emergence of purusha is the imposition of the will on this condition of sensitivity. The instrumental sensitivity is now acted upon by a certain kind of power of will, first from the mind, but then directly from the purusha, which can impose upon it various forms of endurance. This is the point he's making over here. At first, the forms of endurance may be mental. And that's why he's saying this aspect of mind over matter, or mind over body, or over life, is something that begins the sign of the emergence of purusha in nature. But as that grows, that needs to be replaced by the development of a true emergence of purusha. Either it emerges within or it emerges due to the accession of consciousness above. And that's the point he's making towards the end, that even higher than, you know, the power of weird physical insensibility is what, instead of the natural insensibility with which lower creatures experience life, there has to be developed a power of willed physical insensibility, or a power of mental separation from all shock. And this is the power, and from the willed sensibility to the power of separation, we are moving from the instruments of prakriti to the pure purusha. So that willed separation of the mind from all shock and injury is the discovery of the purusha within us, not subject to the responses of the instrument, of the prakriti. That can then be brought into contact with the prakriti and increase its capacity. Now, going still further, he points out, more significant is the power that comes on the level of spiritual mind or over mind, to change the vibrations of pain into vibrations of ananda. This is a very major part in the transformation of the physical as well as of the vital that Sri Aurobindo is talking about, and constitutes an entire aspect of yoga, which first starts with the action of mind over life and body and then seeds way to the emergence of the purusha and the ability to transform experiences of limitation into experiences of ecstasy. So this is what he's talking about. And he says that indicates the possibility of an entire reversal of the ordinary rule of the reacting consciousness. It can be associated too with the power of self-protection that turns away the shocks that are more difficult to transmute or to endure. So there is also the possibility of rejection, the possibility of transformation, possibility of rejection, and the possibility of a kind of, assimilation of the various experiences that we have. These will come more and more naturally. So in this paragraph, he points to an entire development, which is more like a yoga, but through the ascent of consciousness with the arrival of the Gnostic consciousness, these abilities will become natural. So Gnostic evolution at a certain stage must bring about a completeness of this reversal and of this power of self-protection, which will fulfill the claim of the body for immunity and serenity of its being and for deliverance from suffering and build in it a power for the total delight of existence. So these are really ultimately the aspirations of the body and its role, where it is supposed to go. It is supposed to become something which is immune, which has arogya, which is secure in its own consciousness, which is stable and capable of rest, and which is also capable of action, abounding energy, and finally, which is capable of the total delight of existence. Whatever experiences come to us, the body should be able to accept it as an experience of delight. So this is ultimately the transformation that will happen. And in terms of the Gnostic being, he's speaking about this energy, the kind of Deha Shakti that we talked about, getting transformed into a kind of energy that flows, inundates the body, flows into the body and inundates cell and tissue. So it's felt concretely as a certain kind of energy upholding the material existence. Luminous materialization of this higher Ananda could of itself bring about a total transformation of the division to adverse sensibilities of physical nature.
Maybe we covered this one last week. Just briefly, like I'm trying to understand it. Only the awakening of Prakriti has happened in last 100 years and not that much of Purusha. That is the reason, even though we have more sensibility, we are suffering more. Is that correct understanding?
Yeah, that's what I believe is the case, Sita, because that suffering is arising due to the fact that now there is a call for reversal of consciousness. The uneasy station in which mankind finds himself today arises because we have lost the insensibility of inconscience, but on the other hand have not been able to replace that protection of the inconscience by power of Purusha's will. So this is an uneasy place where, in a sense, you know, the same kind of experiences that were treated more or less like a kind of a normal or natural, mankind was capable, one may say, of much more suffering without giving too much thought to it in the past. And of course, you have other animal kingdoms that take it for granted, as it were. Now, we have come to a point where we don't take it for granted anymore, and yet our consciousness doesn't have the force or the, you know, and on the other hand, it doesn't have the insensitivity to, you know, take it for granted, to absorb the shocks of life. So, at this point, what is necessary is another mechanism which will substitute for that inconscience, and that is a willed ability to withstand the forces that are coming into us. That can only come through the Purusha.
Another question is this increased sensibility is what psychology terms as increased individuality? Are they kind of related or the same?
Maybe there is a relationship, but I wouldn't say it's the same. increased individuality, it is true, maybe increased individuality is also a sign of the emergence of Purusha from behind the veil. Ahamkara itself, as it develops distinct characteristics, is pushed to the front to some extent by the awakening Purusha. Now, on the other hand, we may say that it is also having effect on Prakriti by making it more developed, by making it more distinct. And that distinction is, you know, to some extent a greater, finer resolution of our responses. That resoluteness is perhaps related to this Prakritic sensitivity. But I would say the Prakritic sensitivity is more like a general consciousness rather than something which is individualized.
So, Devajishna, how do you balance between, this absorbing the shock versus sensitivity? On one hand, sensitivity, like awareness, brings sensitivity. On the other hand, bearing the shocks requires to some degree a certain insensitiveness. How do you go from one to the other?
So here, exactly, that's what this chapter actually brings out. If you look at it, he's given the stages. The first stage is the development of a certain degree of mind over body, or mind over life. So in other words, how can we develop our endurance? That part is also related to, you know, in the kind of Sapta Chatushtayas, the idea of pitiksha, or endurance. So that is the beginning of the use of mental will. The mental will itself, development of mental will itself, is an aspect of beginning of emergence of Purusha. So that is a first step. Then from that, the next step he's talking about is the separation of the consciousness from the responses of the instrument. This ability to separate the consciousness constitutes awareness of the mental Purusha. So this mental Purusha that is experienced as something which is not affected by the movements of Prakriti, that is related to Udasinata in the Samatha Chapter. That is ability to rise above whatever we are experiencing with nature. Body might be suffering, life might be suffering, all our thoughts might be suffering, but something in us does not suffer and we are aware of it. That becomes the beginning of the handle of Purusha upon Prakriti. So next comes ability to use that particular power of separation to create a new indifference on the experiences. Equality can be imposed on Prakriti if we have a certain understanding that something exists in us that is not touched by Prakriti. So then next he talks about rise in the status of the Purusha. Purusha can rise to a higher station and from there bring a higher power, higher Shakti into the instrument. And then the instrument's capacity automatically increases. Up until this point, we are talking about using the instrument's capacity as it is, but using the will, as it were, to extend it, or using the separation of Purusha to give it greater, you know, scope. But if we bring a higher Shakti into it, then we find that the body's capacity automatically increases to its own true ability to, you know, sort of experience much more. So that's when you start talking about not the sensibility which has become, you know, sort of aware of the forces of nature, but unable to bear them, but now the sensibility that is aware but also able to bear them, experiencing everything as ananda. So that is the transition from a certain condition of a halfway house of Prakriti to the fullness of the emergence of Purusha, transforming the power of a Shakti of Prakriti.
Thank you, Devashish. That was most beautiful.
That's how he develops it in this paragraph, actually. It's interesting because, short paragraph, but he's got all these various links he has established over there.
So I think you were referring also to the record of yoga, the Samatha, where he speaks of Nati Udasinata. Is that the section that you're referring to? Nati Udasinata.
Yeah, I was talking about at least those two. First one is Titiksha and the second one is Udasinata, that form the first two stages of the emergence of Buddha. And Nati would be, of course, a certain, third stage, one may say. And then there is the active part of the Samatha Chatushtaya, which would relate to the change or transformation of Shakti in the instruments by bringing a higher force, a higher kind of ability, a spirit into it.
Yeah. Thank you, Devish. Alexander, would you like to read next?
An aspiration, a demand for the supreme... Can you hear me?
Yeah.
A demand for the supreme and total delight of existence is there secretly in the whole An aspiration, demand for the supreme and total delight of existence is there secretly in the whole make of our being, but it is disguised by the separation of our parts of nature and their differing urge and obscured by their inability to conceive or seize anything more than a superficial pleasure. In the body consciousness, this demand takes shape as a need of bodily happiness, in our life parts as a yearning for life happiness. A happiness in our life part as a yearning for... A keen, vibrant response to joy and rapture of many kinds, and to all surprise of satisfaction. In the mind, it shapes into a ready reception of all forms of mental delight. On a higher level, it becomes apparent in the spiritual mind's call for peace and divine ecstasy. This trend is founded in the truth of the being, for Ananda is the very essence of the Brahman. It is the supreme nature of the omnipresent reality. The supermind itself, in descending degrees of the manifestation, emerges from the Ananda, and in the evolutionary ascent, merges into the Ananda. It is not indeed merged in the sense of being extinguished or abolished, but is there inherent in it, indistinguishable from the self of awareness and the self-effectuating force of the bliss of being. In the involutionary descent, as in the evolutionary return, supermind is supported by the original delight of existence and carries that in it in all its activities as their sustaining essence. For consciousness, we may say, is its parent power in spirit, but Ananda is the spiritual matrix from which it manifests and the maintaining source into which it carries back the soul in its return to the status of the spirit. A supermental manifestation in its ascent would have as a next sequence and culmination of self-result a manifestation of the bliss of the Brahman. The evolution of the being of gnosis would be followed by an evolution of the being of bliss. An embodiment of gnostic existence would have as its consequence an embodiment of the beatific existence. Always in the being of gnosis, in the life of the gnosis, some power of Ananda would be there as an inseparable and pervading significance of supermental self-experience. In the liberation of the soul from the ignorance, the first foundation is peace, calm, the silence and quietude of the eternal and infinite. But a consummate power and greater formation of the spiritual ascension takes up this peace of liberation into the bliss of a perfect experience and realization of the eternal beatitude, the bliss of the eternal and infinite. This Ananda would be inherent in the Gnostic consciousness as a universal delight and would grow with the evolution of the Gnostic nature.
So here Sri Aurobindo is developing this theme of delight that he has introduced with regard to the action of Shakti in the previous paragraph. And he's showing why this culmination of the action of Shakti and the transformation of the being, whether in mind, life or body, is something that moves towards what he calls the total delight of existence. This idea of the total delight of existence arises from the Upanishadic notion that all has come from delight. Delight is the parent of all manifestation. And actually, in its origin, there is a single kind of harmonized delight at work in all things. Now, we do not experience it thus, because again of the same two basic problems that is introduced earlier. There is discontinuity of consciousness, so that we have different types of consciousness, each claiming its own kind of experience. Mental consciousness, vital consciousness, and physical consciousness, each have their own ideas of what it is that will give them satisfaction. Secondly, each of them is highly limited in its capacity for delight. So it has a notion of happiness, but it is only a superficial notion. And it moves towards this notion by creating a division between the attractive and the repulsive. That which attracts it belongs to the small spectrum of experience that it can actually enjoy. And that which goes beyond that, it either is repelled by it or it smarts because it can't bear it. It becomes unbearable for it. So these are the two major problems. The total delight of existence is a harmonized integral whole of experience that mind, life and body should experience all at the same time. But that doesn't happen because these forms of consciousness are not integrated in us. Secondly, this other problem is another natural limitation to each form of consciousness. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that supramental consciousness manifesting in the being will gradually bring us closer to this total delight of existence. But it will take us there through the development of the power of integrality and unity. We will experience that everything is the expression of the self. And these expressions of the self are harmonized because it is the one being that is in each of them. So what he's pointing out here is that gradually this notion of the delight lying behind the supermind is what will inform our experiences. And so he's pointing to a further evolution beyond the evolution of the Gnostic being, which is what he's calling the evolution of the beatific being. Evolution of the beatific being is the being of Ananda. And this again is related to the Upanishadic scheme of the planes of consciousness which move from Satchit to Ananda and then to Vijnana. And supermind of Vijnana, or the idea of consciousness, the real idea of Satchitananda, is what is manifesting here as the one in the many. As that is experienced in a manifest manner, we experience harmony and integrality and identity. But behind these, we start experiencing light. So these are the two kind of levels through which this power of delight, power of the being of delight, manifests with the supramental consciousness. First, in inherent supermind. Second, as the next stage of evolution released from supermind. So this is what he's pointing out here. And therefore, Ananda or delight, the bliss of Brahma, is what will gradually replace both the problems. In other words, the problem of the lack of integrality of the being, because we will touch upon a certain power of delight which exceeds the delight of each of the instruments and is seen to inform each of them. And secondly, by the transformation of the capacity of mind, life and body, there will be an ability to experience the fullness of delight or experience every experience as a form of the total delight of existence.
Nature of this delight has the no shadow, it has no opposite of it. It's the reason why we can experience every, look at every experience that way.
Yes, indeed. Because this delight is the very nature of Brahman. Ananda is intrinsic nature of Brahman, and manifestation of Brahman which does not veil itself, unveiled manifestation of Brahman in the human being or in whatever we can't call ourselves human beings or Gnostic being, if you call it that, is something that must experience the intrinsic delight of Brahman in every experience. So there isn't any lack of capacity there. Purusha is fully manifest as the experiencer of Brahman. What the Veda calls the eater of honey is basically Purusha. Purusha in Vedic and Upanishadic idea is really Satchidananda manifesting its own power or capacity of experience. It is self-experiencer as the eater of honey, as the experiencer of delight in every way and all at once. So that will be realized, that which is not realized because of the sacrifice of Purusha working in the ignorance through duality and through limitation and fragmentation. These are the problems that cause the duality of pleasure and pain. But once these problems are overcome, knowledge of integrality is the normal realization, then there can be no shadow to the bliss in the experience.
Devashish?
Yeah, Vince.
I have a vague question. In terms of, for instance, consciousness, when it knows itself, in identity, it's knowledge. But isn't knowledge a category? It's not as wide as, say, existence of consciousness. You're talking about delight, and that's like an aspect of Satchit Ananda. I'm getting a little bit confused, but that's an aspect that it's full. I mean, it's developed sometimes kind of uniquely, but the full experience of it would be equal to all the others. But consciousness, when it knows itself, is knowledge, but knowledge has a limit.
Yeah, what were you saying about knowledge, Vince? I get what you're saying about delight, because you can say delight is intrinsic nature of Satchidananda, of Brahman. But also delight is present in every expression of Brahman. So if Brahman is self-manifest as varieties of experience, every one of these experiences has its own kind of delight. I think this is one of the things you were points you were making. But what exactly were you saying about knowledge?
Well, knowledge is an aspect of existing consciousness. How can you say?
Knowledge is an aspect of consciousness.
Right, but it's only an aspect. It's not knowledge is an aspect of consciousness. The consciousness is evolving.
Yeah, now, as we know, knowledge is of various kinds. Each one of these properties, like Ananda, for example, is an intrinsic property of Brahman. Therefore, you may say that can be even seen as the primary property of Brahman. It's a way of seeing. It's only because mind looks at each one of these properties separately that we can see Brahman as any one of these. That is, Ananda can be the name of Brahman, for example. So similarly, Jnanam can also be the name of Brahman. Knowledge can be the totality of Brahman because Brahman is self-conscious. So property of consciousness turned upon itself gives knowledge. But on the other hand, knowledge is even prior to consciousness because that is knowledge by identity. Just by being, Brahman knows itself. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I
so, from that point of view, the root of knowledge is as intrinsic as delight. That's why delight also is a form of knowledge.
Thank you. I still have to think a little bit about that, but it's coming closer.
Sure.
Sitaram, do you want to read next?
I wanted to say one more little point to Vince, as a matter of reflection, as you said, these are all matters of really contemplation, of reflection, that, Brahman has two, they've looked at from another point of view, Brahman has two primary properties. One is its oneness and the other is its infinity. Brahman is one and infinite at the same time. Now, when we say that Brahman is infinite, this is something that Sri Aurobindo points out. To conceive of the subjective experience of infinity is only possible as delight. Because it is free of every boundary. It is free of every limit. That absolute freedom that infinity implies can only be captured by the experience of bliss, by delight. This is why delight is intrinsic to the infinity of Brahman. On the other hand, similarly, knowledge is intrinsic to the oneness of Brahman. Brahman is one. Self-contained, it knows itself as one. That centering of the Brahman is knowledge by identity. It knows itself as identity. See? So these are the two polarities, you may say, that coexist just as one and infinity coexist as such in such a level.
Oh, thank you, Devashish. I really enjoyed reading that chapter. Chapter 5 on the yoga of self-perfection, about being, perfection of being. We talk about being and becoming. And I like to think about that kind of stuff, but I find you just explained it so nicely in that chapter.
About the yoga of self-perfection, I just want to add to Vince and say that, especially after reading Life Divine, the synthesis of yoga reads so much more easily. Of course, we may be missing a lot of things, but it's just so smooth after that.
Yes.
Sitaram, do you want to read next?
Sure. ecstasy is a lower and transient passage. The peace of supreme is the supreme realization, the consummate abiding experience. This may be true on the spiritual mind plane. There, the first ecstasy felt is indeed a spiritual rapture, but it can be and is very usually mingled with a supreme happiness of the vital parts taken up by the spirit. There is an exaltation, excitement, a highest intensity of the joy of the heart, and the pure inner soul sensation that can be a splendid passage or an uplifting force, but is not the ultimate permanent foundation. But in the highest essence of the spiritual bliss, there is not this vehement exaltation or excitement. There is instead an illimitable intensity of participation in an eternal ecstasy, which is founded on the eternal existence and therefore on a beatific tranquility of eternal peace. Peace and ecstasy cease to be different and become one. The supermind, reconciling and fusing all differences as well as all contradictions, brings out this unity, a wide calm and a deep delight of all existence are among its first steps of self-realization. But this calm and this light rise together as one state into an increasing intensity and culminate in the eternal ecstasy, the bliss that is infinite. In the Gnostic consciousness, at any stage, there would be always in some degree this fundamental and spiritual conscious delight existence in the whole depth of the being, but also all the movements of nature would be pervaded by it, and all the actions and reactions of the life and body, none could escape the law of Ananda. Even before the Gnostic change, there can be a beginning of this fundamental ecstasy of being translated into a manifold beauty and delight. In the mind, it translates into a calm or intense delight of spiritual perception and vision and knowledge. In the heart, into a wide or deep or passionate delight of universal union and love and sympathy and joy of beings and joy of things. In the will and vital parts, it is felt as the energy of delight of a divine life power in action, or a beatitude of the senses perceiving and meeting the one everywhere, perceiving as their normal aesthesis of things a universal beauty and a secret harmony of creation of which our mind can catch only imperfect glimpses or a rare supernormal sense. In the body, it reveals itself as an ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of spirit, and the peace and bliss of a pure and spiritualized physical existence. A universal beauty and glory of being begins to manifest. All objects reveal hidden lights, vibrations, powers, harmonic significances concealed from the normal mind and the physical sense. In the universal phenomenon, is revealed the eternal Ananda.
So here he's starting with this discussion of delight, of ananda, and its comparison with the peace of the Supreme, as he says over here. And of course, that first line itself is a contention. It has been held that ecstasy is a lower and transient passage. The peace of the Supreme is the Supreme realization, the abiding experience, the consummate abiding experience. Now, this contention, of course, is something like a kind of one side of the argument or debate in Indian spiritual tradition. In fact, these are the kinds of debates that create the distinctions between schools like the Shaiva school and the Vaishnava school. Shaiva school believes that highest goal of humanity is to experience unity with God, and notion of supreme peace, while Vaishnava school believes that highest goal of humanity is to arrive at ecstatic relationship, dualistic relationship with the divine, and that relationship's sort of greatest expression is bliss. Now, this is not merely a distinction in the Indian schools, but if we look at world religions, we can divide them up, in fact, into these two major kinds of approaches, dualistic approaches and non-dualistic approaches. The non-dualistic approaches usually privilege a kind of identity which is experienced as peace, the oneness of the experience of reality, while dualistic experiences usually privilege rigid and this, you know, ecstatic, you know, experience. So he takes up this, and he is, in a sense, first drawing our attention to the more, you know, kind of the one that is more commonly held view, which is that it is indeed the peace that is superior to the ecstasy. And ecstasy is a kind of a passage, a lower form. Of course, as I said, the Vaishnavas will hold the opposite view. It is not necessarily the only view that he is beginning by proposing. Of course, he himself in this passage will reverse that view. The point he's making over here is that delight is the foundation of experience. Experience exists for delight and for the increase in the capacity of delight. Now, the way he goes about it, however, is to point out that this notion of ecstasy as a kind of passage towards unity, towards the sense of the One, is usually had, I mean, he's not denying it, he's saying it does happen as a passage or as a transitional experience, because there is a certain amount of exaltation of the emotional being that occurs in the ascent towards union. As one comes closer to the reality of God, there is a certain response of the emotional parts that under the, you know, sort of influence of this greatened being experiences ecstasy. Now that's the point he's making over here about the vital parts that respond with exaltation, excitement, and intensity, highest intensity, is the joy of the heart and the pure inner soul sensation that can be a splendid passage or an uplifting force. But then he says, but is not the ultimate permanent foundation. So here is, in this particular paragraph, what Sri Aurobindo is establishing is something very profound, which is carried into a more practical sense of what is, you know, the form of experience that is opened up in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. And you see, in a more easy manner, one may say that both Sri Aurobindo and the mother have pointed out that without the development of the capacity of consciousness and ultimately its ability to unite with the cosmic oneness, whatever we call ecstasy is only an incapacity of the being. You know, as they say, it is easy to dance and sing and jump about when, you know, a very little drop of bliss can agitate us. But if there is this tremendous ocean-like consciousness, then that consciousness itself is experienced as its own form of bliss. And that form of bliss only deepens without there being this kind of a exaltation, or what he's talking about here as an excitement. The excitement is a natural, of the Ananda bliss is a natural component of the freedom and infinity of identity with the Supreme, with the Being. This is the point he's making, and he's saying that, so in, as far as Sri Aurobindo's development of spiritual experience is concerned, and this paragraph also relates to the previous paragraph, it is only supermind that can base the manifestation of Ananda. Or one may say that securing the sense of oneness, the sense of unity or identity with all things, the supreme peace of the knowledge of identity, that becomes the basis of the Ananda consciousness, the delight consciousness that enters into being. In this sense, you know, most of the Vaishnava schools, which have given a lot of prominence to experiences of ecstasy, including fainting, swooning, dancing, and this also moves to other ecstatic movements like, for example, mystic Christianity and the experiences of swooning in it, or of Sufism. This kind of a sort of a exceeding of capacity at some point is undoubtedly experienced, as we were discussing again in Synthesis of Yoga. That is the Sushupti stage, the stage of trance, that marks the sort of point at which the capacity is exceeded. But the growth of capacity is also something that has to be promoted to the extent that there is the ability to keep one's eyes open and experience the oneness of God in all things. That firm stability of the supramental experience becomes then the basis for the experience of Ananda. So here he's saying that as that develops, one starts experiencing the Ananda in different ways, even in the different instruments. For example, at the level of the mind, there is a perception, a clear perception of the complexity and oneness of truth. How things relate to each other, seen as an enormous whole. That perception itself is something that gives enormous delight. And that delight is far beyond any kind of simple delight of some intuition that we may have, or even some contact at the with the truth. Similarly, he's talking about the emotional being experiencing the oneness in all beings. That becomes like a natural condition, not a sporadic ecstasy, but a firm and natural experience in all things, in all with all beings. Similarly, again, as far as the life energy is concerned, one experiences the one energy working in the world as that which uses one's influence to flow through one. And that is a kind of an infinite power that is using one's will and instrumentality and bringing its own delight through one. And finally, he's talking about the body and the way in which the senses perceive and meet the one everywhere. Everything is actually perceived as the one. And in that perception is a great delight. And that is the normal aesthesis of things, the universal beauty and secret harmony of creation, of which our mind can catch only imperfect glimpses or a rare supernormal sense. This would become the natural condition of the experience of delight as the experience of the Gnostic being. And finally, he's talking about this, what he touched on earlier, this flow of ecstasy through the nerves and through the body, and also a change in one's physical perceptions. Jagrat, the waking state, will reveal the lines and movements of the spirit of unity and harmony in the world. That's why he's saying all objects reveal hidden lines, vibrations, powers, harmonic significances concealed from the normal mind and the physical sense. In the universal phenomenon is revealed the eternal Ananda. So within oneself and outside oneself, this power of delight manifesting in all things as a normal condition, not as an extraordinary condition, will be felt at all times.
Devashish?
Yeah.
That was very, very beautiful. I have a rather pedestrian question. When you talked about Vaishnavism and Shaivism, would Tantrism be included in the Shaivism? Am I saying it right?
Yeah, not really. Actually, you bring up a very good point. It's not a pedestrian question at all. It's a very profound question. Because Tantrism, in that sense, also believes in making the highest goal the experience of delight. So in its highest sense, and there are Shaivite schools that unite these two, the union with Shiva and the experience of the delight of Prakriti or of Shakti are both held to be the goals of Tantra in its highest sense.
Oh, thank you.
As you remember, this is the reason why Sri Aurobindo comments in the Synthesis of Yoga that to use the methods of Vedanta to achieve the ends of the Tantra is what his yoga kind of proceeds to do.
Yes, I remember that from talking about it at one of the workshops. Yeah.
Right.
Monica, do you want to read next?
Actually, I have a question.
Oh, sorry, please.
Yeah.
So,
is the in the beginning of the passage, that is the initial state, is what is saying is that this exaltation or ecstasy, is it because the unity is still missing at that point? Because the unity is not fully realized. That is the reason for exaltation. The whatever ananda that is pouring in, it immediately, the capacity is not built, and that's why it has to manifest itself as ecstasy. Is that correct? And is that what is happening?
Sorry about that. I was muted. Yeah, the answer is yes, indeed, exactly what you're saying. That is that there isn't a secure foundation in unity or identity, and the exaltation is arising partly due to that and partly due to lack of capacity, so that there is a certain, you know, very, very quickly or easily there is a sense that one's limits are crossed and something very powerful is being experienced as an ecstasy. But if you see, and you were talking about Samatha Chatushtaya, Samatha Chatushtaya exactly goes through those very same steps, and that's why in Samatha Chatushtaya, the quartet of equality, the ultimate goal is hasya or laughter, which is a kind of very intense form of bliss, almost ultimately arrives at perfect identity, which realizes automatically the intense delight in all things without feeling it as a separation or feeling it as an incapacity. So answer to your question technically is separation and incapacity. These are the two problems of our limited experience of ecstasy being felt as something you know, like an exaltation, which easily passes the boundaries of capacity.
So, like, how does the ananda manifest in the initial stages? It has no form, or like, how does it just helps develop the capacity in the initial stages?
No. He's pointing out exactly how it manifests even in the initial stages. You know, with, as he's saying, that with growth in yoga, ananda also manifests in every part of the being. That with the growth of knowledge, there is ananda in the mind. With the growth of awareness of unity in emotional, you know, experience, there is ananda in the heart. With the growth of knowledge of the one energy in all things and the performance of nishkam karma, there is ananda in the vital. With growth of you know, the refinement of the senses, there is ananda in the body. So in all these, the ananda starts establishing itself as there is growth of consciousness and settlement of the sense of whiteness and unity.
Thank you, Devashish. So this establishment is the development of capacity. That's the intent.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Devashish.
Yeah.
Can I ask? When I go for my when it gets close to the time when I go for my brain care, they're about to do radiation or whatever. When the time gets really close to me, kind of, I don't know how to say it, but whether you're gone or not gone, to me it gets to be like it just seems like a big joke. Now, I don't know whether that's my denial, but it just seems very funny to me.
How do you feel that? Is that a certain, are you relating that to a certain form of ananda? That is that there is a separation of the being through which all these things are felt to be, you know.
I think that's what happens a little bit. It just seems like it's a big joke. I mean, you know, something to laugh at.
Interesting.
But Devashish, the speaking of the joke, but I mean, sometimes you can see the world as mithya, or illusion, and sometimes as a mockery also.
Yeah.
Well,
but there is no, it's some part of you which is telling it is knowledge. basically knowledge is driving that.
Yes.
But at the same time, we have this place where I want to know where is the ananda playing a role here. In the knowledge of basically to see the world as a kind of illusion. Where is ananda playing that? Is it in the mind where it is establishing?
Well, actually, you see, for example, let's go to the notion of hasya that he's talking about over here. Now, hasya or laughter can be of various kinds, but ultimately the root kind of emotion of hasya is coming from adbhuta, from sense of wonder. That, you know, like he is giving the example of Sri Krishna at play in the garden of the world, like a child. So it's almost as if whatever it is that we are experiencing is a matter of wonder that is awakening this intense sense of delight and laughter. You know, the laughter of wonder. Something wonderful is happening all around. That is the ultimate, you know, seed of the delight of laughter that he's talking about. So in that sense, even the experience of illusion, and if I am to realize that there is an illusion around me, it's a matter of wonder, it's a matter of laughter, that how could this be that an illusion can appear real? So that's the nature. It's not the nature of sarcasm or satire or irony. Is a lower form of that laughter. The true form of that laughter is pure delight, sheer delight that comes out of wonder at everything. Everything is wonderful because you wonder at how infinity manifests in these manners.
But the opposite of ananda, the regular day-to-day experience, like lot of bitter. Sometimes bitterness and negation of your own self, also a form of mental understanding which is establishing in yourself. So what is, I'm trying to distinguish between these two things. One you just described and the quite opposite of it, which is also giving the same type of experience. Trying to distinguish these two, what is the main difference here?
No, the difference is, Sita, that if you actually experience something to be unreal due to reaction of various experiences, then that is a partial step towards arriving at truth. Because it's only by separating ourselves from what seems to be reality that we can arrive at truth of reality. So, but once truth of reality is achieved, then even what seems to be reality is reabsorbed as reality. See? This is the whole thing. I mean, we take the partial reality to be the truth in our ignorance. But as we move towards knowledge, it reveals itself to be partial. But when we arrive at full knowledge, we return back upon the partiality and see that that also is a manifestation of the divine. Everything is lila of the divine. There is one place where Sri Aurobindo is saying, fullness of experience is when anything that we see, feel, touch, smell, taste is nothing but the divine. So that is the culmination. In the meantime, we have to move from a perception of falsehood to a perception of truth. In that transition, there is a certain type of experience. That is what you are talking about. But that experience still has duality to it. It is only when that duality is completely crossed that one can talk about the laughter of the gods.
Thank you, Devashish. That's very helpful. So that's when you really understand the true hasya.
Right. The true hasya is, there is no nirananda to the true hasya. There is a, just like you were saying earlier, that the unshadowed delight, there is no nirananda that can be measured against the ananda. There is only ananda. And everything is giving the same intense ananda without any sense of, you know, of difference. I mean, the qualitative difference may be there, but there is no sense of, you know, opposition to it.
Thank you.
Actually, since it's getting close to 9:30, I was thinking we could stop for today and continue next Thursday.
Yeah, absolutely. I just have to say that we'll have to take a break next Thursday because, in fact, I'll be kind of coming up to your part of the world next Thursday.
Oh, really? So are you there the entire weekend or? Because most unfortunately, actually, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I am coming down to that side.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, just the very weekend.
I
see. Yeah. So, when are you going to be here?
No, I have some work at... Pardon?
When are you going to be here?
Well, I'll be leaving on Thursday and arriving Thursday evening.